This is the SF Signal Podcast, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And tonight, Fred and I are chatting with Howard Taylor, creator of Schlock Mercenary, who also does a little podcast that some of our listeners might be aware of. It's called Writing Excuses. There's a couple of other unknown guys that are on that as well. Howard, how the hell are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on the cast, Patrick. It's
no
good
problem
to be here in my office talking into my phone.
Hey,
I'm sorry, I just dispelled the illusion of confluence there, didn't I?
That's okay. You know, last time I saw you, you were sitting at your booth at in the dealer's room at Worldcon, and you had a ton of people standing around waiting for you to sign some stuff. That must feel great.
It feels really, really good. Worldcon is more than any other convention I do. Worldcon is my people, and I'm glad I discovered that. My friend Eric Stone, fan of the comic, he's a local writer here in Utah. Won a Nebula Award this last year for his Mormon space whale story. Back in 2006, he said, "Hey, you know, you can share hotel with me, and I'll drive. Just come on down to WorldCon in Los Angeles." And somebody, I can't remember who it was. I was fairly impoverished at the time, but somebody had a membership that they were willing to part with for free. And so I went to LosCon, and people kept stopping me in the halls saying, "Oh my gosh, you're Howard Taylor. You're here. Nobody told me you were going to be here. This is so cool. Do you have your books?" And I realized that I needed to be exhibiting at Worldcon. And so when Worldcon was in Denver in, what was that, 07? Or maybe it was 08. I guess it was in Denver in 08. Yeah, it was in Japan in 07. When it was in Denver, we decided to exhibit and had a fantastic show. And I've been at every Worldcon since.
That's awesome.
Great event for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. Like I said, you were surrounded by people, so... I was one of them. I went up, you know, because Fred has been telling me about Schlock Mercenary probably since we started the podcast. He's always bringing up Schlock Mercenary. Fred, have you been aware of the webcomic from the beginning, or did you catch on later?
I think I started reading it in 2002 or thereabouts. And as actually, that was one of my first questions, was I'd been reading it since 2002. And around that same time, I had been reading a couple other daily strips. But those have one of those have faded because of family problems. Another is kind of staggering along. But Schlock Mercenary keeps coming out 7 days a week, sometimes as many as three gorgeous panels on Sundays. You know, how do you do it?
I work ahead, and it's good time management, really, more than anything else. Well, good time management, and I take a lot of shortcuts. when I first started cartooning, Sluggy Freelance went into hiatus because Pete Abrams and his wife had a baby. And I remember, even with all the guest strips that were running, I remember being incredibly disappointed that I wasn't getting genuine, bona fide Pete Abrams Sluggy Freelance. And I told myself, I had already started web cartooning, and I told myself, well, I will never do this. And the only way to make sure that I ever do this is to always work far enough ahead that life's little curveballs don't derail me for long enough that I run out of buffer. Now, at the time, my wife and I already had two kids, and so I knew about how much buffer I would need in order to have a baby and get by, well, have Sandra have a baby and me get by. It's a lot easier on the dad than it is on the mom. And I figured, you know, about a month is what I need to keep in the can. And so I always tried to work a month ahead. And sometimes I've been, on rare occasions, I've been as much as 2 months ahead. And on less rare and much more frightening occasions, I've been as low as, 1 or 2 weeks ahead, which is about where I am right now.
Wow. Now, the science fiction community is pretty tight. And I think you feel that when you go to Worldcon. There's also a community of people who are doing the web cartoons or the web comics. You've got a lot of people like Scott Johnson, and he's doing the My Extra Life, and then he's got the other one that he just renamed, the Duck something or now. It's the Duck something now. And then you've got Kurt's doing PvP Online. You've got the Penny Arcade guys. Are you aware of any of what they're doing? I mean, is that the same kind of feel of community?
It's different, but very similar. That came off fairly dichotomous, didn't it?
No worse than my question.
Yeah. In the science fiction community, there's a huge range of fans and authors, and many of those authors have been writing for decades, and so you have this very long-standing fandom. In web cartooning, the vast majority of the people who are web cartooning professionally started it within the last 15 years, and many of them, you know, I'm considered an old timer at 10 years. Well, I guess it's 11 and change now. The Penny Arcade guys, Scott Kurtz, they've been doing it for longer than I have, and there are, you know, several other people who've been doing it, well, Pete Abrams and J.D. Frazier. And I'm going to offend somebody by leaving him off the list. Suffice it to say, there are a lot of people who have been doing it longer than I have, but there are zillions of people, it seems like, who haven't been doing it as long. And the end result of all this is that the community of creators is very young, very vibrant, and is only now beginning to mature, where a lot of these creators are in their 30s, and they're having children, and are... Again, in an attempt to offend everybody, starting to act like grown-ups, and so it's a very different fandom, or a very different creative community. The other thing that I found is that, and this comes back to what I was saying about conventions before, when I go to a comic convention like San Diego Comic Con or Emerald City Comic Con. When I go to one of those events, the fans who are there are fans of comics, and it's very, very difficult for me to stand out, particularly difficult for me to shine, because I taught myself to draw at the time I was starting my comic, and so my art is fairly immature. Here I am almost 44 years old, and I've only been drawing for about 11 of them. Most of the cartoonists, most of the comic book creators who are my age have, 25-year careers, and not necessarily the web cartoonists, but even the web cartoonists, many of them have been drawing a lot longer than I have. And so it's very difficult for me to stand out, at least on an artistic level. When I go to science fiction conventions, I'm one of a very few exhibitors there who has product with pictures in it. And that's one of the reasons why I think they do so well. Fans of science fiction have a hard time finding good science fiction comic strips, and I happen to be making one, and so I stand out very nicely. I do well at the local literary sci-fi cons, Life, the Universe, and Everything, that's held at Brigham Young University, Conduit, which is up in Salt Lake, and I've done lots and lots of other literary sci-fi cons. Balticon leaps to mind, In Conjunction, Ad Astra I've done twice, and these are shows where fans, so they're small shows, 800, 900 people, but I'm received much more enthusiastically at those shows than I am at Comic-Con or Emerald City, which might have 20,000, 50,000, 100,000 people in the convention center on any given day.
Sure. Fred?
That's I'm sorry, you let me, I will just talk and talk and
oh, that's
talk.
Fine. I'm the same way, and so I'm trying to sit here and shut up and let Fred ask some questions.
Well, earlier today I did a tweet that I had come up with 6 questions. I figured that'd be good for around 3 hours or so.
Okay. Well, but, let's have one of them. And
sure. Well, I, of course, like you know, ebooks and other fields, there's several places where people say, well, if you just give it away, you'll live off it somehow. But you've actually managed to make this work. Can you talk a little about the business end of Schlock?
Sure.
How it is that...
Yeah, the webcomic business model, I think, is better suited than any other creative endeavor that I'm familiar with for what I call the free content business model. And the reason why is that it's a product that is fairly easy to, I say fairly easy, I don't want to belittle the work that, you know, I and my many peers do, but it's fairly easy to create an update that is satisfying and that can be consumed relatively quickly. You know, we all know what attention spans are like, and will therefore have a good chance of being spread across a wider audience. You know, webcomics are popular among people who sit in front of computers for a reason. They, you know, you can consume them quickly, or if you really want to kill, you know, 2 hours or 2 weeks, you can dive into the archives of something that's long-running and serial, and you can...
Not that I've ever done that. Not that I've ever done that.
Exactly. Now, contrast this with a couple of the alternatives. The record business. There are a lot of bands who put their music online and then hope to sell records. Well, putting music online, if I'm going to listen to your music, that's not a short attention span thing. And I've got a short attention span. I listen to music online fairly regularly, but you really only have 15 or 20 seconds to convince me that I really want to listen to the whole piece. And even if I do really want to listen to the whole piece, the odds are good that I'm sitting in a setting where I can't listen, you know, out loud to the whole piece. You know, I have to wear headphones or something. And so it's inherently restrictive. Add to that the fact that creating a 5-minute song is very, very time intensive. I was a record producer for years, studied music. You know, 5 minutes of music time might represent, you know, 50 hours or more of studio time and rehearsal time and writing time and everything else that goes into it. And so the record business, it's really difficult to create compelling content regularly so that there's enough of it to really keep the site going for a while. Now let's turn the page again to ebooks, fiction, whether it's genre fiction or anything else. Sitting down and reading a 1,000-word short story takes a lot more time than sitting down and reading a 4-panel comic. And when you're done reading the short story, it's very easy for the reader to say, well, that's really not any different from a blog. And, you know, blogs are free. And this is just a blog that was completely made up, so it's fiction. And so a lot of people don't see the value in it. And what I'm coming back around to is the fact that web cartoonists seem to do pretty well with the free content business model, while people who give away their books online, people who give away their music online, perhaps aren't doing as well, or there are fewer of them who are able to succeed in the middle of the power curve. Now I could be completely wrong. You know, somebody in the comments section could post numbers and say, oh, there's actually 10,000 bands who are fully employed by just posting their music to the web. But I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And there is a parallel a little bit between what you're doing and what some of the folks doing fiction are doing, because there is like for the cartoonists or the comic strip artists, I mean, there is the syndication, there's the newspapers, there's the King features and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So there is like two paths you can take. And I think the people who take the King features kind of path, you know, kind of frown upon the guys who launch a website.
You know, I've done the back and forth with the cartoonists who say don't give it away for free, because they're, you'll never be able to make any money at it. And You know, people who say, well, the only way you're really making money at it is by, you know, selling T-shirts. You know, you've become a clothier rather than a cartoonist. And the fact of the matter is, I make my money selling print, just like a lot of other people who sell comic books. And when I'm putting the comic online, what I'm doing from a, you know, high-level business standpoint is advertising the books. And the books are, the books carry the business. And if I can also make money by, you know, adding T-shirts or dice or board games or whatever else to the mix, you know, whatever the intellectual property will support, whatever the fans who still have money in their pockets at the end of the day, you know, maybe they're not book buyers, but they would dearly love to have some Schlock Mercenary dice. You know, I'll try and find ways to engage them. I don't think, with regard to comics online, I don't think that it's a business model that will work for everybody. In particular, I think that the editorial cartooning business simply can't succeed as a webcomic. I'm dependent on the goodwill of my fans. You know, my readers need to love what I'm doing, and they need to like me. And a political cartoonist will, an editorial cartoonist will, of necessity, be pissing off about half their audience with every update.
Sure.
You know, regardless of which half, regardless of which side of the political fence you're on. And the result is that, you know, a reader-supported or a fan-supported editorial comic is going to struggle unless it's completely one-sided, you know, and just pandering to one half of the political spectrum at a time. And then I think there's something wrong with the art. You know, an editorial cartoonist really is supposed to be even-handed and broad-brushed and making everybody angry and making everybody laugh. And so I don't know how to save editorial cartooning. And when I say save it, I think that newspapers are in horrible shape, and editorial cartoonists have been getting laid off for the last 4 years, and we're just not seeing as many of them, you know, gainfully employed as we used to, which is yep. Sad because, done right, it's a brilliant, brilliant art form, and it teaches more people about current events more quickly than anything that those, you know, Pulitzer-winning journalists can write.
Sure. Fred, what else you got?
Well, I will let the audience at large know this. They may not be aware of that. Howard is one of two, and possibly down the road we'll see a third, web cartoonists who have managed to derail a force of science fiction nature, namely John Ringo. Howard, would you like to talk about how you managed to suck John Ringo into your universe?
I ran into John Ringo at PenguinCon several years ago, and we got to talking, and when he realized that I was writing military science fiction in the comic, he decided to go read it. And apparently the military aspects of the science fiction I'm writing are good enough that a mil sci-fi writer like John can be won over by it. And you know, that's at once very flattering and you know, a little humbling. John went through a dry spell a few years back and emailed me and said, hey, I'm wondering if I could tell a story based on the Schlock Mercenary universe. I want to tell the First Contact story. And he and I talked a little bit about you know, whether or not this would be official canon. Mostly what I did is I said, you know, John, go tell the story that you want to tell. Don't try and lock yourself into the comic, because the tighter you try to lock yourself in, I think the less fun you'll have and the more likely you'll be to fall back into this dry spell. And so he wrote, you know, several, I guess there's three out now or four?
Three, and the fourth, I think, is scheduled for early next year.
Okay. Anyway, so he's written these novels that are ostensibly set in the Schlock Mercenary universe. There are all kinds of reasons why canonically it might not fit. But in my introduction in the beginning of the first book, I said, hey, you know what? I'm telling the story 1,000 years after the fact. who am I to say that, you know, all the eyewitnesses are dead. Who am I to say that the guy writing the footnotes for Schlock Mercenary in the 31st century knows history exactly as it happened? And that's fine. John's telling a good story. I'm telling a good story. If anybody is just so anal that they can't, you know, so OCD that they have to find a way to reconcile every possible conflict between these stories, those OCD folks probably just need to stay home and sort Scrabble tiles, because it's a fruitless and frustrating endeavor.
So now that we're like 20, 21, 22 minutes into the podcast, why don't you tell our listeners, you know, what Schlock Mercenary is?
Ah, well,
just in case.
Little bit of introduction then.
Yeah.
Schlock Mercenary is epic science fiction being told four panels at a time. It's formatted like the comic strips you may have loved in your youth, which are comic strips that I loved in my youth. Calvin and Hobbes, Bloom County. They ran very short story arcs, and they made comments about current events and about society. And then if you hearken back even further to the old Buck Rogers serials, which were telling adventure stories, you know, every day in the newspaper, what I sought to do was something similar. I wanted to do send-ups of the world that we live in. I wanted to make people laugh at the faults and foibles of humanity as we know it, but I wanted to tell a fun science fiction story. And so that's what I do, you know, four panels on weekdays, 8 to 12 panels on Sundays, with some exceptions, because, hey, it's a webcomic. You know, I'm not trying to appear in a newspaper anywhere, so I can break all kinds of rules if I want to. Sorry about the chime there. Apparently, I just received email. And,
that's okay. As everybody hears that noise and they go to look at their own email.
Exactly.
I've had people hear the Skype noise when we were recording in there, and they think it's their own Skype.
Awesome.
So that's kind of funny. You know, you mentioned Calvin and Hobbes and Bloom County. Those were two of my favorites. And I tell you what, to this day, when I see a snowman, I think, boy, Calvin would have done that a lot better.
Yep. Yep. And I think one of the tragedies of the syndicate model is that the syndicates were not able to keep Bill Watterson happy about cartooning.
He's done now, right?
Calvin and Hobbes is done, and he's not cartooning anymore. He's doing other things. If you look at the introduction in the beginning of the complete Calvin and Hobbes, it becomes very obvious that he always wanted to be a cartoonist. He was super enthusiastic about being a cartoonist, but the way those businesses were run really turned him off. And so it ran for 10 years, and then when he decided, you know, these characters, I don't want to keep retelling the same jokes, I just need to be done, I think the world really lost something. And I feel like if the syndicates had been more attuned to his creative needs, if the syndicates and the newspaper business in general was treating the comic strip more like the art form it really is, then maybe he could have been happy and we'd have, you know, something new from him. And the same goes for, now I'm drawing a blank.
Gary Larson or Berkeley Breathed?
Gary Larson and Burke Breathed. Thank you. Burke Breathed, his children's books are wonderful. A Wish for Wings That Work. I can't remember any other ones offhand. Gary Larson's There's a Hair in My Dirt. These are books that I love, and they reflect this same creative genius and artistic whimsy that made their comics so much fun in the newspaper. But now the only way to get them is to, you know, go buy a book.
Right. And you know what, Gary Larson, to this day, he's one of my favorites, and I miss him so much. I miss The Far Side. I really do. And now, another one that was a favorite of mine was Bill Amend with Foxtrot.
Yep.
And he's taken Foxtrot to Once a Week Online.
Mm-hmm. And Bill Amend had for a long time, I think for a long time, back in 2000, he had a tutorial up that talked about how he created his comic strip. And I remember reading that tutorial and thinking, aha, so that's how it's done. Excuse me. And I started laying out Schlock Mercenary with the same sort of process that Bill Amend used to lay out Foxtrot, right down to the hand lettering. I gave up hand lettering after about three strips when I realized that, one, it hurt a lot, and two, even my best hand lettering was ugly, and three, it took 10 times as long to create a comic that way as it took if I just typed the words and used some comic fonts. And so I strayed from the template a little bit and ended up creating my own little process for cranking out comics. But credit where credit is due, Bill Amend's tutorial, which is sadly no longer online, got me over the initial learning curve hump.
Very cool. Fred, you want to take us back on topic again?
Of course. Well, what's very fascinating about Schlock Mercenary is that, I mean, you have your four color panels each day. And, of course, you always end with a joke. But somehow, when you sit back and you take, for example, I just reread the first seven volumes in print form. You see a story that develops. Now, I know that various episodes of Writing Excuses, your favorite catchphrase is luxury, whenever the other gentleman, and now Mary Robinette, talks about revising. But I mean, how detailed a story do you start with when you start a new chapter in the Schlock universe?
It has changed since I started doing Writing Excuses. When I look at the first five volumes of the comic, the beginnings, the middles, and the ends are quite a bit rougher, and the ends are not, to me, to my more sophisticated now than perhaps they were then tastes, they're not as satisfying as I want them to be. And that's just something that happens. Even if I'd outlined them and had the luxury of revising, they probably would have been unsatisfying, or they would probably be unsatisfying now because we grow as artists and writers. That's just something that we do. Nowadays, the story I want to tell needs to have some sort of a skeleton to it before I start writing or illustrating anything. The story that I just finished online, I say just finished online, I guess it finishes Saturday, November 12th. This airs on November, 18th?
Yeah, we do a timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly thing, so this will air next...
Timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly. Okay, so fine, I can talk about the next 2 days from...
This will air on the 17th.
Okay. So the book that just wrapped up, Force Multiplication, going into it, I knew that I was going to take a small cast of characters, I was going to put them in a new location, and I was going to send up, to some extent, healthcare, and I was going to, one of the themes that was going to run through the book and was actually going to weave in from several angles is the title itself, Force Multiplication, the idea that there are things that you can do in order to make one person much, much more effective in combat or in business or in anything else. So starting from that point, I then, started looking at the, plot stuff, and I very early decided that I was going to use people as, breeding tanks for these nanomachines. And of course, I'm borrowing a page there from Frank Herbert and the discovery late in the Dune series that the Xlotl tanks are actually, you know, that's where all the, is it the Flylax? The Dune folks are going to jump all over me for getting these names wrong. But that's where all, that's what all their women are, is, you know, the axolotl tanks are their females. And I thought, oh, well, that's, you know, let me borrow that idea. But that can't be the big reveal. The big reveal needed to be something else. And that's one of the principles that I've learned from writing Excuses, is the first idea that you have for a plot twist is usually not very good. And I played with some other ideas and finally realized that the big plot twist, with regard to how the medicines are being produced, needed to be that, you know, people were being used as the manufacturing process, but they didn't need to be. Somebody was crippling the system in order to make that happen, in order to kind of keep a lid on what was going on. And it's all very, you know, twisted and crazy. But once I knew that, I sort of discovery wrote my way from point to point, about two-thirds of the way into the book, and then sat down with my writers group and handed them all the scripts, the outline notes that I had, and the buffered strips for the rest of the book, which, you know, the buffered strips were only like, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, plus all the stuff that had gone before. And my writers group sat down and they identified for me all the things that they thought were promises to the reader, all of the things that they thought were Chekhov's guns, all of the things that they thought might be red herrings, the things that they thought might be running gags. And as I looked at this, I realized, oh, wow, you're paying attention to some completely different things than I was paying attention to. And that's good to know. That's where, I can't remember which joke it was that came back. One of the jokes that came back was a result of that. They were very surprised when I said that one of the jokes that I was going to bring back was flying soldiers on the battlefield are called skeet. But everybody was delighted with that joke. I thought that was a fantastic payoff. But that's where those sorts of things come from, is we sit down and we look at the first two-thirds of the book, and then we say, okay, what are the promises we made to the readers? What are the things that are actual foreshadowing? What are the actual clues? What are the red herrings? How does this pertain to the story? And then I went up the mountain. My son was at scout camp, and I sat down on my iPad and just started writing and scripted my way through the last 3 months of the book, not with full scripts, but I knew all of the events, I knew all of the POVs, I knew all of the order dependencies, I knew all of the things that, you know, had to happen in just such the right way, or, you know, just such a way to set up something else later. And that was all one writing session. And then the rest of the scripting was just, in comparison, it was just chop wood, carry water. You know, hard work's been done, now all I need to do is write believable in-character dialogue that delivers a punchline every day while still advancing the story.
It's interesting that you say that, you know, being a part of Writing Excuses has actually changed a little bit how you do things.
It's not a little bit, a lot. I mean, it was doing Writing Excuses where I finally realized that I was writing satire. You know, when I talk about the creation of the comic and my goals, I did not understand that I was writing social satire. I thought, oh, I'm going to make fun of boy bands this week. Next week, I'm going to make fun of institutionalized medicine. What I did not realize is that this is a long-standing genre. It's called satire. And the fact that I wasn't making fun of science fiction meant that I wasn't writing parody. If I told a bunch of Star Trek jokes or Star Wars jokes, then I'm writing parody. That wasn't what I was doing. I was using a serious science fiction setting. Well, you know, mostly serious. I wasn't making fun of science fiction, mostly. Sometimes I did, but, you know, I keep waffling on that point. Yes, it's serious, hard science fiction, and I'm sticking by that gun until somebody shoots it.
Award nominated 3 times for the Hugo Award science fiction.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. But the things that I'm making fun of are things that we do today. and that's what makes it satire. And I didn't have this discovery until 2008, 2009, and that changed my approach. Not a lot, but a little, because when you're aware of something that you're doing, even if you've been doing it reflexively and naturally and comfortably for years, when you're aware of it, when you are conscious of the mechanics that go into it, you are now better able to refine it. And once I started refining that, I was able to look at some of the writing. I was able to look at the process that Dan and that Brandon used, and I was able to refine that. The thing that hasn't been refined a whole lot has been the artwork, and I think the biggest change, the biggest enabler for change anyway, was when I hired Travis Walton to start doing my coloring. It used to be that I would sit down with a script, and as I was scripting, I would tell myself in my head, okay, this joke's not funny enough, I'll fix it with the artwork. You know, we're going to put a funny expression on somebody's face, and that's what's going to sell the joke. And in fairness, comic strips have to do that. You know, the art has to sell the joke, and the writing has to sell the joke, and the two have to work together. And that's just fine. If you're doing the art and the writing yourself, all I needed to write was the dialogue, and I just remembered in my head that this is what the picture was going to do. Well, often I'd sit down and start drawing the pictures, and I would realize, looking at the flat line art, that there needed to be some communication of depth, there needed to be some communication of movement, and I would tell myself, oh, I'll just fix that in the coloring. And then I'd sit down to color it and be miserable because all of the burden for making this strip work has fallen on Photoshop, and it's not my favorite tool in the world. When Travis started coloring for me, I had to start writing down for Travis what it was that I expected the coloring to do. And I realized with some of the very first strips he colored that I wasn't communicating enough in the line art for him to put highlight and shadow and movement and depth and expression into these characters. He wasn't coloring it the way I was imagining it, and he wasn't doing that because I wasn't telling him enough using my line art. So I stepped up my game a little bit, and I think that's why the strip looks so much better now than it did, just 3 years ago.
Interesting. I'm hoping that Clifton's going to be listening to this episode. How did the whole? I'm going to run a little bit over here. How did the whole writing excuses come to be?
Writing excuses happened. First of all, there's going to be an episode of Writing Excuses where we talk about how Writing Excuses happened, but that's going to air probably 2 months after this airs. Fair listener, head on out to writingexcuses.com and listen to episodes of Writing Excuses, because if you like to write, or if you really love seeing and learning about how good genre fiction is made, you'll love the podcast.
Yes.
Okay, enough of the plug. Writing Excuses came about when Brandon's brother, Jordo, who was taking a media class, Brandon Sanderson, his brother Jordan, taking this media class and said, Brandon, we should do a podcast. And Brandon said, what on earth are we going to do a podcast about? And he said, well, you and Dan, your writing buddy Dan Wells, you guys are really funny together, so the two of you should talk about writing. And Brandon said, I can't be funny just with Dan. We need somebody who's a professional funny person, and also we need somebody who knows how to drop the internet on our podcast and make it be popular. And they came to me. It's very funny to me to listen to the two of them talk about the origins of the podcast, because at the time, my internet following was enormous compared to either of theirs. And yes, I really did carry the publicity of the podcast for the first little bit. And then Brandon got tapped to finish Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time. And Dan's books went all, crazy book list type stuff. His trilogy that begins with I Am Not a Serial Killer, much more satisfying than any episode of Dexter you'll ever watch. There are a lot of people who compare it to Dexter. The John Cleaver books are better. I Am Not a Serial Killer. Anyway, the two of them are doing fantastically. And the podcast had grown enough that within the last year, we decided to bring in Mary Robinette Kowal. And her puppetry skills, her writing skills, she's the only one of any of us who've actually won a Hugo Award. have added so much to the podcast. I feel like a cabbage head who's very, very lucky to have firmly stapled himself to the coattails of these other fantastic writers.
That's awesome. I actually had the opportunity to hear that story live at Worldcon, so that's awesome. You talk about Brandon getting tapped for the Jordan gig. I've said it before. I don't envy him that. I think he's doing a fantastic job, but it's one of those things where we kind of talked about before. Someone somewhere is not going to be happy with him. You know, it's like the Dune people. You said, the Dune people are going to be all over you for mispronouncing or saying something. There's going to be people who are going to be, I can't believe you did that to Rand. I can't believe you did that to Bubba. How dare you? You know, he never would have done that. And I don't envy him that. But I walked up to him at Worldcon and I said, hey, dude, you know, thanks for doing that. You're awesome. You know, good job. Keep at it.
Let me spin it a different way. If Robert Jordan had lived to finish this series himself, if only, because he had hundreds of other stories he wanted to tell, and it's a tragedy that we lost him when we did.
It is.
But if he had lived to finish the story himself, there would have been people who got to the end of those books and said, oh, that's really unsatisfying. You really betrayed us. You know, mm-hmm. You didn't fulfill this promise, and you were totally phoning it in book seven. I can't believe you did that. And so the criticism that Jordan would have gotten, which would have been, you know, fair or unfair, it would have been completely earned, because an author earns criticism by putting a book out into the marketplace for people to read. Brandon is now getting that, and he's getting it for different reasons. You know, oh, Jordan never would have done this, even if that's stuff that was
right,
explicitly in Jordan's outline. So really what Brandon is getting, any heat that he gets, Robert Jordan would have gotten, only from maybe some different people, and it's just part of being an author who sells half a million books.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Fred,
I pulled that number off the top of my head. I don't know if half a million is the right number.
Fred, do you have one last question to ask before we start plugging websites?
Well, I was going to spend 10 to 20 minutes asking about the Chepequazo, but I think we'll move to, you know, that I can buy dice for my Schlock miniatures. What's this I hear about a Schlock mercenary game?
Yes. Long story, very short. I met an avid gamer and a writer by the name of Walter Hunt at Worldcon in Denver. One thing led to another. He introduced some gaming friends who make games for a living.
Walter Hunt, who's also a author?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, he's actually eaten lunch in my house.
Well, see, I closed that loop for you. he introduced me to the Ape Games guys. The Ape Games guys started prototyping, you know, doing some game design. We threw out a game version that we didn't like, and just last week, hey, look at me doing the time travel thing. Just last week, the Kickstarter project that we put together for Schlock Mercenary the board game funded. We needed to raise $25,000 in order to be able to manufacture the game at the quality we wanted to be able to manufacture it. And we raised the money and are now headed into the overfunding bonuses, where we get to add extra stuff to it. I'm excited by it. And what's so much fun about it is that when I played it, I realized that the characters played true to the comic without feeling like the game balance was forced. It was fun, and it was funny, and it was very tactical, and it was very strategic. And it'll probably be out in May, and we'll definitely have it with us at Gen Con in 2012.
What, it's not going to be ready for Christmas?
If only I could, you know, collect money, November 17th and turn around an entire manufacturing thing in time to ship it to you for December 25th. That would be awesome. We don't live in a world with PD stabbers yet.
So that's awesome. Congratulations. You got the game coming. You also have a calendar coming.
We're running pre-orders right now for the calendar, the Schlock Mercenary 2012 calendar, which will feature the first 12 of the 70 maxims of maximally effective mercenaries, including things like Maxim 1, which is pillage then burn, Maxim 3, an ordnance technician at a dead run outranks everybody, and Maxim 12, which is one of my favorites, a soft answer turneth away wrath. Once wrath is looking the other way, shoot it in the head. So we'll have the first 12 as, you know, 12 monthly pictures, and the calendar's 15. And if you want me to draw a picture on the last page of your calendar, you can get a sketch edition of the calendar for 25.
By the way, that reminds me, I think it's awesome that in your books, I've got the Tub of Happiness here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's awesome that that you leave a page blank in the back of the book.
That is one of the business decisions that I made early on that has done, I say one of, that business decision to leave that blank page there has done more for my bottom line than any other single decision I've made. Because, you know, I charge $10 to do a sketch, and that results in thousands of dollars of extra money when I do a book release, and makes it that much easier for the book run to pay for itself and for Sandra and I to pay the bills. You know, the average comic book sells maybe 4,000 or 5,000 copies. You know, a really popular comic trade paperback might sell 20,000 or 30,000 copies. And the people who are involved in it need to be turning out books, you know, every couple of months in order to make a living. I can turn out one or two books a year and sell between 2,000 and 5,000 of them and support my whole family and be able to afford to pay a colorist. And, that's the only other person we're paying right now. We want to be able to, you know, hire some additional help, but we're not quite ready to give that much back to the economy yet.
That's awesome, though. But I'm feeling like I may have been special because I don't remember paying $10 to have you draw a picture for me.
Oh, when I'm at conventions, I don't actually charge for the pictures.
Okay.
You've already paid money to come to the convention,
gotcha,
and you bought a book, and I'm sitting right there. What else am I going to do? Well, I'm going to draw a picture for you. And one of the nice things about me drawing those pictures is that while I'm drawing pictures, I'm also drawing a crowd. I was at Gen Con sitting next to Jim Zub. Zub is a much better artist than I am, and Zub was doing some commissions. You know, he charged, you know, $20-$50 for a nice commission, and I was doing pictures for free in the back of books that I sold. And I would go through, you know, 10 or 15 pictures easy in the time it took him to draw a commission. And he realized, looking over at me, that what he was doing was visual art, and what I was doing was performance art. And they're both very, very valuable. You know, people treasure the sketches they get either way. What I was doing had a really strong marketing value for our booth, because, you know, my hand was always moving, and pictures were just flowing out, and it's kind of amazing to watch it happen.
It was very cool. Well, you know, we've kept you a little bit longer than I had intended or promised, so we better get going here.
We've kept your listeners for far longer than they're accustomed. And like I said, I just talk and talk and talk.
Oh, Howard, you have no idea. These people are used to me, and I always say 30 minutes, and then I go 50.
It's just this thing. Is that what we told them, 30 minutes? Because 30, you've been 35. On the phone for like an hour.
Yeah, I know. That's they're used to it, trust me.
Right.
Why don't you tell folks where to go to find your stuff? What's the websites? What's the Twitter and all that good stuff?
Okay. You can find the comic for free at schlockmercenary.com. And there's full archives online. Or you can, you know, just start reading today and read tomorrow and hope that you know, the story unfolds and you just sort of figure it out as you go. Don't be scared away by the deep archives. If you want to listen to Writing Excuses, head on out to writingexcuses.com. And if you want to follow me on Twitter or on Facebook or Google+, just look for my name, Howard Taylor, T-A-Y-L-E-R, and you'll find me, no problem.
Very cool. Well, thanks for coming on tonight, Howard.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.